Our guest today is Roger Waters, one of the founding members of Pink Floyd, bassist and co-lead vocalist. Roger has been touring his version of the classic Pink Floyd album, The Wall, live, first in the U.S. last year and now beginning an extensive European tour. Roger led Pink Floyd after Syd Barrett left in 1968 through their amazingly successful 70s album, The Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, Animals, and The Wall. He left the group in 1985. The Cafe's Michaela Majun talks with Roger today, and she begins by asking him about the incident that led to him coming up with the idea behind The Wall.
On the Animals tour of 1977, we were in Montreal playing in the Olympic Stadium, and some poor youth, overcome by his enthusiasm, at some point during the show was scrabbling his way up whatever they had in front of the stage to protect us from their love. And this kid actually got very, very close and irritated me to the point where I think I gobbed in his face. I don't think I did. I absolutely know I did.
And gobbed means?
Spit. Okay. Spat at him. Horrific thing to do, obviously, and in hindsight, something that I regret. In fact, I regretted it that very day. I went back to the hotel and looked at myself in the mirror and thought, what on earth are you doing? You know, there's something very, very wrong with this picture. And I started to examine all of that, and I realised that I was at the time feeling very alienated from the audience, in particular, and maybe from the world in general. And the idea struck me that it might be a good thing theatrically to do a rock and roll show at some point where we physically built a wall across the front of the stage, expressing this sense of alienation and walling the audience off from the stage. So I did a little drawing of it and started to show it to people, not least the other guys in Pink Floyd, who quite reasonably thought I was completely insane. I pursued the idea and persuaded them and others that it was a good idea theatrically, and eventually we did it a couple of years later.
How did you convince them of that?
Rock and roll bands survive by ideas almost alone. You know, everybody in a rock band is desperate for somebody else to write a song, because you know that if you run out of songs, you're screwed. That's the end of it. That is in the world of modern day rock. After the Beatles, in 1963 or 4 or whenever it was, gave us all permission to write our own songs and express ourselves and make music that was about something more than Moon and June and love, which we all started to do, and we thank the Beatles for that, because as far as I'm concerned, they were, certainly in the world of pop, they were the pioneers, they were the vanguard of that, and gave the rest of us permission. Though obviously if you go back into the roots of where they came from, others had been doing this for umpteen years beforehand, mainly African Americans.
Getting back to The Wall, there's such depth to it. When you put it out, did you think it might not be as successful as your earlier blockbusters?
No. When we finished it, which was in 79, I think, I listened to a playback of the whole thing. I remember thinking, this is just magnificent. This is going to equal the success of Dark Side of the Moon. Which equally, I have to say, I remember taking Dark Side of the Moon home, a half-inch reel-to-reel of it, and playing it for my then-wife, and her sort of bursting into tears three-quarters of the way through it because she found it so moving. And I thought, well, that's good. That we've obviously done something right. And The Wall was similar. It was always a very powerful piece, and you know, it was beautifully produced and everybody played beautifully on it. And I always thought it was going to be hugely successful.
And so it was. We're talking with Roger Waters today on The World Cafe. The protagonist of The Wall is called Pink. Is he more like you, or is he more of a composite of the members of the band, or who?
He's a composite. He's probably 70% me and, you know, 25% Sid Barrett, and the other 5%, if my maths is correct, is, you know, a sort of mixture of John Bonham and all the other kind of, you know, all that stuff about smashing up hotel rooms that is part of the narrative is something that I may have admired from afar. I don't recall ever having smashed up a hotel room myself or thrown a TV set out of the window. But I think when I heard of those you know, acts of rebellion, they always felt somewhat heroic, and I think I rather admired them. So that's why they're in there.
Let's talk about Comfortably Numb for a minute. It had and has a kind of universal resonance, and you seem to encapsulate in it the attitudes of several generations, the arc of the numbness of deprivation and war of the 1940s, suburban life in the 1950s, drugs in the 1960s and 70s. Talk a little bit about creating that song and what it means for you.
At the time, I was in conversations with Bob Ezrin, who was co-producing the record. And by this time, we had decided that we needed a scene in our narrative with a doctor. And so I took that chord sequence of Dave's, and then I wrote a verse. I mean, musically constructed the verse and sort of put it together, and then wrote this little story that is based upon something that happened to me years before in the Spectrum in Philadelphia, when I had had a stomach bug, and it was before a Pink Floyd gig, I was in real pain. I'd got terrible stomach cramps, and so I got the hotel to send a quack up to the room, and he said, oh, we can sort that out. He didn't say it in a stupid English accent, obviously, because he was an American person from Philadelphia. He said, we can sort that out for you, young chap. Just roll your sleeve up, and I'll just give you a little shot, and you'll be fine. And I to this day, I have no idea what it was that he pumped into me. But I can only think that it would have been the sort of thing that you use to calm a Siberian tiger if you're going to pull its teeth out, because it rendered me incapable of anything except the very, very most basic pretense of still being alive. And I did the show, but I couldn't feel anything at all, and my arms felt like lead. In fact, it's the only time that I've ever done a show and there's been an encore, and I've not taken part in the encore. When they said, come on, you got to do an encore, I said, no.
You just couldn't do it.
No, I couldn't do it. I could no longer move at all. So, and it reminded me, the feeling that I had reminded me somewhat of a feeling that I had had as a child with a very high temperature, where I'd started to hallucinate that my hands were way too big for the rest of my body. Strangely enough, Jerry Scarfe, who was a great collaborator in this work, when he had had a fever, had had exactly the same hallucination. So maybe it's quite common. With me, it was two things. One, that my hands were way too big for the rest of my body. And two, I would see the world as if I was looking through a telescope or a pair of binoculars the wrong way, that it would see everything else seemed very, very small and distant. So in the lyric in the song where it says, there is no pain, you are receding, a distant ship smoke on the horizon, that is, somehow that is attached in my memories to a high fever and a feeling of terror that visual hallucination can induce. I'd felt it once before, probably in 1974 or 75, in the canteen at Abbey Road Studios, EMI Studios in Abbey Road, where I was sitting at a table with the band, and I was under a lot of stress at the time. I was in one of my many marriage breakups, and right in the middle of it. And I suddenly realized that this thing was happening to me, even though I didn't have a fever, or there was no physical reason why I should be, why the world should look as if I was seeing it through the wrong end of a telescope. I can remember thinking, "Oh, this is not good. In fact, this is very bad. This is what it must be like to have a nervous breakdown. There's suddenly you have no control over anything." And so, and actually, I managed to stand up and somehow got through the door and got up the stairs, and I went into number 3. And there was a nice Steinway in there, and I sat down at the piano and started to play the piano. And slowly, over a period of 4 or 5 minutes, bit by bit, the world returned. And I feel very strongly that on that day I was actually on the abyss of, being taken away by the men in white coats so that they could help me with, electricity and all that stuff.
But music brought you back from the brink.
In this case, yeah, playing the piano.
Wow. So what do you make of an interpretation like the one I gave, looking at that song as kind of describing our culture in many ways?
There is no question that I hold the view that the unchecked consumerism of most of our lives renders us uncomfortably numb in insidious and not very subtle ways. And So that feeling is always something bubbling under. And when you're writing a song, or when I'm writing a song, I can't speak for other songwriters, but I get a sense when I listen to other songwriters whose work I like. There may be a straight line somewhere in the song, but what gives the song its power and poetry is that tangential to this, to the straight line of the narrative, there are arcs of meaning and experience that break off to the sides and which make connections with all kinds of other things, and make the song open to interpretation by the listener in a myriad of ways, and that is what makes good songs and what makes good poetry.
Smoke on the wind.
We're talking with Roger Waters today on the World Cafe. He's about to start the European leg of the 30th anniversary production of The Wall, a whole new production. The new production, talk about how it's changed and what relevance you see in it for right now, especially right now with everything that's going on in the Middle East.
Well, yeah, right now is right. If anybody who's really interested in any of this in depth and detail should go to my website, rogerwaters.com, and there on the website, there's a whole load of little windows, and one of them says, "Why am I doing The Wall again now?" And it's a fairly long piece, but basically, in the intervening years between when I did it then and when I'm doing it now, I have understood that the microcosm that is the narrative of Pink, that's me, Sid, little bits of John Bonham and other weird people. That is a small story about, you know, troubled young men. But within the notion that troubled young men build walls around themselves in order to immure themselves from the pain of relationships and so on and so forth, is a much bigger story. And the story is this, that nations and ideologies wall themselves in because they are frightened of the possibility that there might be something wrong with them. And so they try. So nations will identify the evil ones, other foreigners, this or that, in order to persuade themselves that the sense of inferiority that most of us feel to some extent, at least during our lives, is actually unreal. Because if you can identify an enemy, then you can feel better about yourself. And a lot of foreign policy is based upon that idea that we can all feel good about being American or whatever, or, you know, or Iranian or whatever we might be, if we can identify somebody who we feel badly about. And I think that's a general theme running through politics at the moment. Though at this very moment, those walls seem, at least to some extent and to some good extent, to be failing. And it may be that they fail for this reason. It may be that they're beginning to fail because the developments in the technology of communication that have happened over the last 30 years give ordinary men and women the chance to better understand one another across these national and ideological borders and boundaries.
Roger Waters is our guest today on the World Cafe. I want to go back to something you just said. Why were you a troubled young man?
Oh, my goodness. Well, as is a big part of the beginning of the story, I was very troubled when in February 1944, when my father was killed on the beachhead at Anzio, and so a lot of my young life was spent through floods of hot tears demanding the return of my father, who I missed desperately, even though I never knew him. So that was one thing. Two, I grew up in England in the 1950s when it wasn't so much that there was rationing, you know, and nobody really had enough to eat. And, you know, I never even saw a banana till I was 8 years old and whatever. I don't mean to sound whiny, but it was also that we were living in the aftermath of an inherited Victorian a sensibility that had been handed down through the Edwardians and because of the two world wars had sort of bypassed any fun or joy. And so in the 1950s in England, sex, for instance, was almost entirely verboten. It was... The only real attachment that one as a young Englishman back in 1953 or 54 or 55 or 56 could have was that somebody was going to get pregnant and then everybody would die because it was so awful, you know, and that was kind of it. So there was a lot to be pissed off around. about. And I was. I felt an enormous sense of shame about almost everything, certainly everything sexual. And that's a very uncomfortable position to be in.
Certainly becoming a rock star helped you with that, no?
It doesn't help very much with the shame, no. I mean, I worked through the shame through psychotherapy over many years. Psychotherapy obviously helps. Laughter, I find, helps quite a lot. I don't mean to be flippant about it because it's not a flippant subject.
He said laughing.
I know. Yeah. And what am I going to do? Shoot myself? No.
You were just talking about the fact that technology may, in fact, be the thing that breaks down barriers, or maybe not. That remains to be seen. Let's talk about the technology in your own work. That technology has changed enormously since The Wall came out 30 years ago. And how did the technical aspect of the music bolster your sound and really create what Pink Floyd became? I know that you were an innovator using electronics and other technical aspects in with the sound of the instruments.
I think very little has changed technologically to make making music and moving people with rock and roll or any other form of music very different. The tape recorder was a huge innovation. That made a big difference. It meant that we could start using echo, for instance. But that technology has developed because now it's digitized and you can make very long delays. And so you can create all kinds of atmospheric effects using various digital things, but I certainly haven't heard anything on a record recently that you couldn't do in the late 60s. I don't hear how technology has actually helped anything. What technology has meant in the world that I live in the world of rock and roll, is that people can sit with a laptop in their bedrooms and make really, really crappy music that sounds as if it's been made by a professional, just because everything is sampled and it's keyboard and there are samples. And so you can make something that sounds as if it's been made in a recording studio. But it's still crap, by and large, most of it.
And you can disseminate it all over the world thanks to the technology.
Well, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that. So, but we hope that that gives the esoteric and good that is out there a way of getting out to people, as well as what we also know that it also does, which is negative, which is to encourage the lowest common denominator of public taste, and so that we, you know, the danger of the ease with which information can be disseminated is that we will eventually become dumbed down to a point where there's no room left for anything that's even faintly difficult in any way, you know, or challenging, you know.
What about the technology of mounting the stage show? What's happening with the new production? How does that differ from in the past?
Well, the technology of actually building the wall is similar to the technology that we used in 1979, but things don't leak as much. You know, we used to work with the road crew up to the tops of their gumboots in hydraulic fluid because all the lifts and ramps and things weren't machined to the tolerances that they are today and didn't work as well. So that's developed. But the thing that's really changed is the technology of projection, so that we can do things with projection now on the wall that spreads 244 feet wide and nearly 40 feet high in extraordinary detail. And under extraordinary control. So we can light one brick in our wall. We can light with a piece of projection. And so when we're building the wall, as each brick goes into the wall, we start to project on that space, and we haven't been projecting on that space before. So it's really quite stunning to look at.
Speaking of another brick in the wall, did you always envision the kids singing the chorus in that song when you wrote it?
No, I didn't. What happened was that Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2, was one verse long, and then Dave's guitar solo, and that was it. But there was something about it that I thought was really catchy in a strange way, and I had the notion in post-production, actually, when we were working at Producers Workshop on Hollywood Boulevard in 1979, to try putting kids on it. And so I sent the multi-tracks back to a very close and old and dear friend, Nick Griffiths, who was working at the Pink Floyd Studios in Britannia Row in London, and said, "There you go, mate, put some kids on that." And he famously did. He went to the local, what we call primary school. I don't know what you call a primary school. Anyway, it's kids from the age of 7 till 11. And got a bunch of them into the studio. A very forward-looking music teacher. So anyway, off went the tapes. Nick did it. The tapes came back one day. Cool, let's open that. Stuck it on the Studio 24 track. Right, just push all the faders up and press go. Boom. And there they were. And
the rest is history.
I remember thinking, oh my goodness, that is amazing. That, now, that has suddenly become a hit record.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
We're talking with Roger Waters today on the World Cafe. Last question. What do you see as your legacy in the pantheon of music and rock music?
I don't know. That's not for me to say. That would be for someone else to talk about, somebody who knows about pantheons. I, as you know, don't believe in God, never mind many gods.
Good answer. We're out of time. I could talk to you a lot more. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Roger Waters on the World Cafe. We'll be right back.